morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. How do you get the Democratic message out? We're about to go on air, Katie.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, we're on air and we didn't even know it.
There we go. A
little get that clock fixed. Okay. We have
I'm so glad I was on the
telephone, Katie Hobbs. She's a state senator from Phoenix, from District 24, whose Mike's daughter is actually in that district. She has a BA in social work from NAU, so she knows Northern Arizona, and a master's from ASU, and she's on the adjunct faculty of the Paradise Valley Community College in social issues. She was elected to the State House in 2010, and to the State Senate, I believe, in 2012. She's on the Elections, Government and Environmental Committees, Health and Human Services Committee. And welcome to Democratic Perspective, Katie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I guess we were talking about the show, and Mike wanted to ask, we have your bio, and you're already the state minority leader of the Senate, and you haven't been there very long.
Mm-hmm.
Mike's question when we were talking before the show was, what's driven you into politics from social work into politics in Arizona?
Sure. Well, I think as a social worker, first of all, I think people see us more doing one-on-one counseling and welfare type of work. But if you look at our code of ethics, it talks about being involved in the policy arena at every level. And so I think that being in the legislature to me as part of my commitment to the profession of social work. And I was working with clients and seeing, you know, at every level, barriers that they had for getting what they needed to get ahead, to be self-sufficient. And a lot of it had to do with public policy and the folks at the Capitol making the decisions. And once I connected those dots, I realized that, you know, there's not a lot of social work that, well, there wasn't any. And I wanted to change that. I was actually working on public policy specifically related to domestic violence issues. And so got a firsthand look at the folks at the Capitol. And then I still didn't necessarily connect how to get there, like with the electoral side. So I had a colleague that was involved with a group called Emerge Arizona. And this was back in 2004, and she encouraged me to apply. So I did the program, and Emerge trains Democratic women to run for office. And as soon as I was, you know, in that program, I figured out how the Democratic Party works and how to run for office. And so I committed to run for legislature. So that's kind of how I got where I am. I still am really involved with Emerge. We've trained 12 classes of women now, so if you're a woman, a Democrat, and you're interested in running for office, Emerge Arizona is a good way to go.
I do want to say one of the reasons we're talking to Katie Hobbs this morning, state senator from District 24, is because she is a Democrat and because she seems to have some clear thinking going on,
and we have to have some Democratic people on Democratic Perspective,
and we have to exactly that are and for exactly those reasons too, that we are frustrated with what happens at the Arizona legislature, especially when it comes to education and social issues. And as you, it seems like the driving forces behind your foray into politics was frustration with what the state does and especially what it doesn't do regarding its own citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a social worker, we're involved with people who are just at moments of crisis in their life. And I think one of the skills that we bring to the table is just solving problems. And I think that same skill is utilized all the time in the legislature. So,
I want to talk about Emerge Arizona, too. That's a great organization, and I think mm-hmm. it's maybe certainly hopeful for the future. But what can the state do that it's not doing right now, Katie?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think that our state, and this is reflected all the time in when you see things at the ballot box, how people vote on initiatives, we are much more progressive than is reflected in the legislature.
Amen, sister.
Pardon?
Amen, sister.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and so I think that that we're not sending the right people to the Capitol. And a lot of that has to do with the makeup of our districts and that many of them are overwhelmingly Republican, and the people who vote in the primary are sending the most conservative Republicans to the legislature. So we have to, look at how we are voting in primary elections. I think that the demographics are shifting, and I think that we're not going to be stuck in this super right-wing majority for forever. And I'm one of the people working to help get us out of there. So
you're one of the reasons we're not going to be stuck in this incredibly backward.
And up here in our district, we have some of the craziest and most reactionary people in both the state senate and
that you have
state
to deal with
yeah.
down there.
and that's not reflective of your district at all.
No, we don't.
No,
think so.
It really, really isn't reflective of the district. What happens is that it's just what you said is mm-hmm. that the only people who vote in the Republican primary are the most extreme and conservative Republicans, mm-hmm. and then there are more Republicans than Democrats. And so these people either win handily or edge out Democrats when it comes to the thing. And we think that most people are just voting, they're Republicans, they're just voting Republican down the line. They're not really looking at the total craziness of some of the people coming from our district.
Well, then that's really good. I hear that all. I was sitting at the bar at the Sunup Brewery down there in Camelback. You may be familiar with it, maybe not.
It's in my district.
it's a great brewery down there.
Yep.
And as it became known that I had just been to the Bernie rally, Bernie Sanders rally at the Phoenix Convention Center, the conversation at the bar turned to politics. And even there, these inebriates, quite frankly, I mean, I got there late, and these guys were interestingly expressing themselves. But they believed the consensus was it's a purple state. They kept saying it's a purple state.
Yeah, yeah.
So would you agree with that, Katie?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I think that we have a lot of opportunity to start, we've already gone along. In the Senate, we're two seats away from tying Republicans and Democrats, and that would bring us so much change in what kind of legislation is moved through the legislature. And we would start seeing things that are actually Democratic priorities, and not just Democratic Party priorities, but priorities of most of the voters in Arizona. And so one of the, you asked me earlier about getting to leadership pretty early in my legislative career, and I think, number one, we have term limits, and so people kind of move up quicker. But I think part of the job of leadership is not just leading the caucus in the chamber, but also working to bring about more like being in the minority, we have to work really hard to try to get to the majority. And part of that is the work of leadership. And we haven't done a really organized caucus effort at all in Arizona. And we are changing that. Representative Eric Meyer, who's my counterpart in the House, we are leading an effort, a really strong, coordinated, comprehensive effort to try to win more seats. And to get to majorities, not necessarily in 2016, but building on successes that we'll have in 2016 because of what we're doing right now. And so, your area is an area where we have opportunity. So we're working to get there. And we can make a huge difference if we have one or two more Democrats in each chamber.
And it's such a small number. It seems, mm-hmm. you know, what a difference it would make.
Mm-hmm.
So let's real quickly back up a little bit. We do want to talk more state politics, but I want to make sure we get this in on Katie Hobbs' path to the Arizona Senate. You were frustrated. You turned your attention toward politics, and Emerge Arizona helped you. How? What did they do? And how could so? And as you mentioned, as Steve mentioned, my daughter and daughter-in-law and son all live in your district.
Yeah.
Certainly my daughter-in-law is very interested in politics. And so what would you say to someone like her? Say, hey, what should she do?
Well, I think it depends if she wants to run or just get more involved. I think people that want to get more involved go down to the party and volunteer. In the Phoenix area right now, the focus is on reelecting Mayor Stanton. So there's efforts going on up until the election at the end of August. There's stuff they could do probably every day, phones, knocking on doors. Also, there's a couple of initiatives in Phoenix and a bond override for Phoenix Union High School. So those things are going on right now. So there's plenty of opportunity to get involved. And then a lot of people, their entry in is through some sort of campaign and then getting involved in their legislative district. I know up there you guys are organized by county, but in Phoenix we have lots of legislative districts, so we're organized at the legislative district level. Getting involved there, and then if they're interested in running for office, then I would definitely say look at Emerge Arizona. Our program, it's a pretty intensive training program, and I know that there's lots of candidate trainings, and I always recommend for people to do more than one. Emerge was my very first one, but what was great about it and different than others is, number one, it focused on women, and number two, it's a cohort, and so the women are in this program together for a long, 6 months, and so they build a network, and then once they graduate, then they're part of our entire network of women who have gone through the program over the last 12 years. And then finally, it is much more in-depth and longer than most candidate trainings. So most candidate trainings are a weekend or, and ours is over 6 months, and so you get a lot of more in-depth information.
That sounds really important, actually.
Yeah, and one of the things a lot of people that come in our program have never been involved in the Democratic Party, and so that's one of the first things we help them do. And so we're not only just helping people run for office, but also just building up the party as well, which is really critical.
Yes, and I think women... I'm going on a limb here, they do provide a different kind of leadership, at least than we've seen. I mean, maybe there shouldn't be, or maybe there isn't a difference between male and female leadership, but it does seem that women may focus on the social issues, on the children's issues.
I might be biased, but, I think that women's issues, we have these issues that we call women's issues, but they are issues that affect families and our communities. And for example, the Violence Against Women Act, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, the Family Medical Leave Act, these are all really important issues that passed through Congress. And it wasn't that they were issues that weren't important to male legislators, but they were brought to the table because there was more women in Congress.
Courtney made a big deal.
Started electing more women, and they could talk about how these issues impacted their families firsthand in a way that men didn't always have the same perspective. And so I think that, and these are certainly, the Family Medical Leave Act doesn't just help women, it helps families. The Violence Against Women Act, Violence Against Women is a community issue. It doesn't just affect women. So these are really important issues that get more attention when we elect more women to office.
I agree. Bernie made a big deal out of the Family Medical Leave Act, and we're talking about family values. How the Republicans in this state or anywhere somehow got the lock on family values when the Family Medical Leave Act is huge family value. Violence against women, huge family value.
And it does work. It's done all over Europe. Very, very generous variation on this. When children are born and so forth and so on, there's just a concern for maintaining and supporting the family and asking what the state and the employers can do to make sure that families remain strong and connected.
Let's talk about that great family organization, the Goldwater Institute. how are they involved in Arizona politics? Assume we know nothing up here.
Yeah, okay, so here's an important example. When I started to, and I knew about the Goldwater Institute and haven't really supported any of their causes, but when I saw firsthand kind of that really what they're about is, to them, principles are more important than people. And they talk about principles of freedom. And, you know, you talked about the Republican Party cornering the market on family values, but they've also kind of cornered the market on that word. So when we were debating Medicaid expansion, which was made possible because of the Affordable Care Act,
right.
Then the Goldwater Institute was like the prime organization opposed to Medicaid expansion here in Arizona. And we had a lot of hearings, both about Medicaid expansion and the Affordable Care Act as a whole. And so the room, this was an off-session hearing that we had, and it was the Joint Health Committee in the House and the Senate, and this room was packed. And one side was like a small group of Goldwater Institute people, and the rest of the room was all folks that were there to tell their stories, their healthcare stories, about not just how, you know, I need healthcare, but how having health insurance would save their lives and or lives of their family members. And it was such a stark contrast of how the Goldwater Institute people would get up and talk about these principles of freedom and how Obamacare violated that, contrasted with these people's personal life stories. And it was just so, that was when I was like, wow, I don't care what their principles are. They don't care about people and people's lives.
Don't. Yeah. They don't. They have an ideology, and the ideology comes first. And it's fairly systematic in all things. And they hate government. And so when they look at unemployment insurance, you know, they see something that limits freedom. I don't know. Maybe it's the freedom of employers. But they don't see how Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid create more freedom for the American people. Because if you have Medicare or Medicaid, you don't have to worry about going broke over your medical bills.
Right.
And that's a freedom. That gives you more time, more energy, more personal space to be involved in your life, in your family's life. And so they see all the programs that give ordinary people a chance and expand their possibilities as taking away freedom, because they have this narrow business and wealthy vision of what freedom entails. So, of course, if you have all the money in the world, paying taxes to help other people have medical insurance seems, you know.
I do love that visual of the Goldwater Institute suits over in the corner of the legislature. And, all these people, and in this case, it would be 300,000 Arizonans. They weren't all at the legislature, but that's how many had the Medicaid. They were talking about denying Medicaid expansion.
And I think the thing is that I liked about what you said is that what they're advocating in the name of what they call freedom, and they have this very strange version of freedom, is basically hurting people.
Yeah.
It's taking away the freedom of people who don't have millions of bucks, like the people who fund the Goldwater Institute, don't have their secretive practices and are just out there testifying. They're taking away other people's freedom, who are not as well off as they are, in the name of freedom. It seems an astonishing thing. There's no countervailing, I think is the word, right, Mike? There's no countervailing. There's no Democratic foundations in Arizona like the Goldwater Institute or the Center for Arizona Politics, right?
Yeah, I see it as, like Alec on the national level, the American mm-hmm. Legislative Exchange Council. There's no Democratic side that's writing legislation in all 50 states and providing it to people like Katie Hobbs and who don't have staffs because the government has become so unpopular and it's just people who want to pay taxes for certain government procedures. And so people like Alec on the national level are writing legislation, and on the state level, we have people like the Goldwater Institute, the Arizona Policy.
And people like the Goldwater Institute twist things. So tax breaks for wealthy corporations always become jobs bills, right?
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. I'm the ideology over reason, and certainly as Katie just said, Katie Hobbs here is our guest this morning on Democratic Perspective.
She's the state minority leader, Minority leader.
A young leader in the Democratic Party in the state of Arizona, just the ideology over reason and ideology over people. So let's talk a little bit about speaking of ideology over people, we've just talked about social services. Let's talk about and healthcare in this case. Let's talk about education.
Great.
Arizona is a joke. I mean, it's a stinking laughable. You have and Katie, your colleagues
yes.
have to see that being 51st in education is not good for business, but they don't see that, do they? I mean, my voice goes up. I get a little more shrill as soon as I start talking about Arizona education with anyone. So tell us, how bad is it? And then is there anything that can be done that can the Democrats get some money into it? Tell us what it's like. You're in education. You work a little bit in it. Tell mm-hmm. us your story.
Yeah, okay. So since I think 2009 was the year we started cutting everything because of the recession, and that was also the year that they put they passed the governor's temporary 1 cent sales tax that was supposed to go to education, and most of it, it got offset by corporate tax cuts that were passed as well. So the promise of that wasn't really kept, but we've cut in the neighborhood of $7 or $8 billion over those past 6 years. This year, the governor came out with his budget and it cut more from schools, although he said over and over and over again that it cut less, that it actually gave more money. What there was sort of a shift, and in the end, that shift wasn't even really real. But he talked about putting dollars in the classroom. That's a big talking point on the right, putting more dollars, taking it out of the bloated administration, putting in the classroom. It's a misnomer that administrations at schools are bloated. You know, the non-classroom dollars that they talk about, they go to things like school buses and cafeterias and nurses and even like a lot of programs, even textbooks are not necessarily considered classroom spending. And so when you take money out of those areas, in schools that have already cut as much as they can, to say you're putting it in the classroom, you know how we could shift that percentage is if we actually spent more per pupil. That would put more money in the classroom.
Right.
But that wasn't what the proposal was. And so so then when, you know, the Democrats really won on that message, because the governor's office kept saying there's more money in classrooms. And the general public, I think, knows there really wasn't. We saw people coming down to the Capitol, Republican school board members from Republican school, you know, majority Republican school districts, criticizing this. And what the talking point became, and it has been, I think, since session on the Republican side, really is, well, you can't just talk about funding because you have to talk about outcomes too. And nobody's arguing that. Yes, we should not be just throwing money at an issue. We should be making sure that we're spending money in a way that works. But you can't just like spend money 1 year and expect to see an outcome right away. And
right.
we're having that same conversation around Department of Child Safety too. But an outcome in the school district, which is a pretty big bureaucracy, you have to give it some time to see it work. So that's, you know.
How much time, Katie? A decade?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that we've been cutting for so long that we're not investing their resources. I mean, we're asking schools to do more with less every single year. I think it should take a long time. Like, you can't even just right now give back all the money that we took away and expect an immediate outcome. I think it we have to build back up. The governor came out with a proposal that he's going to try to put through the legislature next year to take more money from the state land trust to put towards education. So right now, and the state land trust exists to fund education. So right now, 2.5% goes to education right now. And that is an amount that protects the corpus of the fund and ensures its long-term sustainability and isn't going to raid the trust fund so that it's not around for decades and, you know, as it should be, as is written into the Constitution. So his proposal is if it passes, it will be on the ballot in 2017. It would take 10% instead of 2.5% for the next 5 years. And then after that, 5 more years at 5%. So then you're up against two big cliffs. So it would start in 2017. There would be a cliff in 2022 and then another cliff, when it stops in 2027. And so there's nothing about addressing how that cliff will be addressed. Right. And their response is, well, we're giving more money and we should be okay with just giving more money. And yes, it's needed and it's a good start. It's too little. It's too late. And we need to do more to make sure it's sustainable and also that we're not destroying the corpus of the state land trust fund.
I noticed the state treasurer, who's a Republican, a conservative mm-hmm. Republican, questioned the figures and stuff. And he basically said, well, we could go to 3.75 or something like that. We can increase mm-hmm. it a bit and still maintain the endowment. So what she's talking about, folks, is it's whether you spend the endowment, the core money that's generating the money. And the governor's proposal, as I understand it, would eat deeply into the endowment. It would take mm-hmm. billions of dollars
Not
from
deeply,
the endowment.
A little deeper.
Yeah. And in that case, what happens is the endowment will have less money to deliver in mm-hmm. later years. And so that seems to be the question. And it was severe enough that the state treasurer said something about it.
Yeah, and he, you know, as a part of his job as treasurer is to kind of maintain the integrity of that fund. And so, over the 10 years of the governor's plan, it would put $2.2 billion more dollars into education. That's not even close to what we've cut over the last 6 or 7 years. And then the two cliffs I talked about, and I think part of the, you know, in 10 years, that won't be Doug Ducey's problem anymore. And so I don't know that he's really concerned about the cliff that happens after it goes back down to 2.5%.
So the increase from the state land funds won't replace what they've cut.
Right. No, not even close.
It's a clever idea in order to come up with some money that won't raise taxes or do anything, but will only hurt the situation down the line.
And it's years in the future.
Yeah, years in the future.
Listen, you can back out of this if you like, but the single primary or open primary, what does a Democrat, or at least Katie Hobbs, think of open primary in the state of Arizona? If open primary is where we just put everybody together, I guess I do have to explain this, rather than having partisan primaries where the Republicans go to the polls, before the election and select their candidates through the primary, Republican candidates and Democrats select their Democratic candidates. We just select candidates altogether. What do you think, Katie? Is that silly? Is it an answer in Arizona?
Well, I think that I would like to see some data from California because they've had this in place now, I believe, for 2 election cycles. And obviously, in California, it would maybe benefit the Republicans a little bit more where it's overwhelmingly, Democrats, that control everything.
Right.
But I'll tell you, we've heard, okay, independent redistricting will help Democrats take back the majorities. Clean elections will help take back majorities. And we haven't seen that happen yet. So I'm a little leery of this great promise that open primaries are going to solve all our problems as well. And what I worry about is that, you know, we have we have districts right now that are overwhelmingly Republican and districts that are overwhelmingly Democratic, more Republican than Democratic districts. And so if you take away the party label, some people just vote by party label, and that helps Democrats in Democratic districts to keep their seats. Or to, you know, at least, you know, hold those seats in the legislature. So then does dark money come in and spend and, you know, tip the balance against Democrats in those districts as well? So I would be concerned about that because there's obviously more dark money on the Republican side than there is on our side. And I don't know in California, has it helped more Republicans win?
I don't know either.
I think it has some. I think you're right in raising the question whether it's solution to everything.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought of the problem, I must admit, of having an open primary with the dark money coming in. And it's mm-hmm. so substantial. And then in the Republican primaries this year, last year were absolutely vicious in the way
yeah.
the dark money was used. We still don't know where a lot of that money comes from. We have the APS, which is a regulated thing, seeming to be able to elect the commission that regulates them. I mean, it's like some, I don't want to insult third world countries, but it's some weird, distorted dictatorship somewhere where everything is phony. The guys who are supposed to regulate the stuff, the police are corrupt or whatever, in some of these countries. And that's what that looks like. And so I think that is a concern if there's no controls over dark money coming into, to districts. You won't know where the money's coming from, folks. Dark money is money that you don't know who's given it. It's usually put through, and Gary could tell you a lot about this. It's usually put through all kinds of front organizations, right, Gary?
You're going to make me talk. After.
Nah, I'm going to make you talk. Yeah,
it's run through nonprofit organizations that are 501c3s and 501c4s. There's actually what happens too often is money is donated to one organization, and it's not enough that it goes into that organization and can be used for politics without restraint. It gets divvied up to other nonprofit organizations so that it's in effect money laundering, so nobody can track where it came from. And there are hundreds and hundreds of these organizations now, mostly all Republican, mostly all funded by the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson.
And people of their ilk. And so that's a problem. The issue of money in politics is a problem. And so it is true that if you have a Democratic primary, that these dark monies are unlikely to come into it.
Let me do a bet.
But if you had an open one, they might. I think it's a good issue, Katie, that frankly I had not thought about. Mike?
Mm-hmm.
I want to do a bad segue here into Child Protective Services became
yeah.
what? What's the name of the new child organization in Arizona?
Department of Child Safety.
Department of Child Safety. Now, they don't seem to be in the news as much as Child Protective Services, but they haven't avoided the news.
You have something on your website about the changes in the issues, right?
Tell us good, bad, indifferent.
Well, a year and a half ago, Governor Brewer's State of the State, she announced that she was, by executive order, creating a standalone agency. And the executive order has, you know, limitations, so needed legislation to codify it and make it permanent. So we had a special session at the end of May to create this new department that went into effect July 1st of last year. And Governor Brewer's, the director that she named was in place. And, it's just like kind of like the education system that we haven't invested in. Just because you create a new agency doesn't mean the problems are going to go away.
Right.
And so a huge issue, and I think kind of if you look at all the things, there's nearly 18,000 children in foster care right now. There is a backlog of some 15,000 or more cases. Those numbers are astounding. And kind of at the root of all of those, particularly the backlog, is that you can't keep qualified staff in the agency. And so something has to be done about that. And I don't know if that's more pay or increasing the numbers of caseworkers that you, I think all of these things are contributing to it. Increasing the number of caseworkers that you have so the caseloads are at manageable levels.
Are people just getting burnout, Casey? Katie, are they just overloaded with cases? Why are they leaving, do you think?
Yeah, I think they're overloaded with cases. It's a job that is emotionally demanding, and it's sometimes just unfathomable, the things that these workers have to deal with every day. And prior to the starting new agency, and I'm not sure how technology has improved now, but people were being sent in the field in just unsafe situations with a pager. We weren't even giving them mobile phones so that they could call 911 if they ran into, and they're going into homes where, you know, if you're talking to parents who are accused of abusing their children, they might not necessarily be really respectful of you and treat you in a law-abiding manner. And so these are dangerous situations that we're sending caseworkers into. They're having to deal with the worst of the worst because, you know, they don't have time to deal with everything in front of them. And so you have these cases that drop off that aren't as demanding. So maybe in some situations we could have gone in and prevented abuse from happening, but because we can't get to those cases, then abuse is happening. So it's just a hole that keeps getting dug deeper and deeper. Part of the legislation that we passed creating the agency included an audit that would be completed within the first year. And that audit just came out. There was nothing, absolutely nothing surprising in that audit whatsoever. It reaffirmed everything that we've been saying for years about the problems plaguing the agency. And it didn't really give a lot of recommendation for how to fix those. There is the director that's in place. So Ducey replaced Brewer's person with Gregory McKay.
Uh-huh.
He's a law enforcement officer. That's his career. He's been in law enforcement. That does not qualify you to run a child welfare agency.
I wouldn't think so.
I think that part of why we have such a huge amount of people in foster care is because the focus is on enforcement rather than prevention. And that's not going to change until we get somebody with a more holistic perspective on child welfare in general and not just the enforcement side. There's many, many of these cases where we could go in and intervene and prevent abuse from happening, provide supports for the families so that they're able to stay intact. But most of the Republicans in the legislature don't see that as the role of government, so they're not willing to fund those kinds of services and resources.
It's the GOP family values again.
That's it. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
So the agency has to have not only different leadership, but more money to do its job. Because if you're just burning out the people you work for or turning them into cynical, and you're going to end up with a few saints and a few sinners working there, and by and large, people want a fairly decent working environment, don't they? And a fairly decent salary. I mean, you don't go into child welfare to get rich, but you expect to be able to make a living, and you expect to be reasonably safe.
Well, that's
and to be able to feel that you're actually able to do your job. I know if you work in a place and you're given tasks that you really can't do, and you just work more and more and more hours to try to get them done, it's very, very demoralizing. There's nothing like for an individual who's trying to do a good job to just be given an overwhelming amount of work. It's really destructive to their morale.
And I want to say this clearly as an ex-teacher, that what you pay people really matters. It really, really matters. In American society, show what we think of people by what we pay them. Not much else. You know, I don't want a watch. I don't want a party. I don't want a biscuit. I want money. Thanks. Because
yeah.
that's what you give everybody else. So I'm sure CPS or child welfare workers and teachers, I'll throw so yeah, please, Katie, deliver that message. I'm sure
yeah.
you already have, but that what you pay people really matters. Even those people that went into child welfare work, people that went into education, still do a better job. I mean, it's really that simple. You do a better job if you are paid adequately. If you want to build a premier education system, pay your people. If you want to build
yeah.
a good social service system, pay them. Pay them the best.
I think it's important to understand the pain of dealing with people who are, in some cases, really abusing their children, and understand the stress at which the workers are under. And I think one of the things we don't do in the society is take care of the caregivers. We mm-hmm. we send people out to do a good job, but are there social workers working with the social workers? Is there, I know that they do a lot of group processes, but is there enough emotional support for them to do this job? I had a friend in New York City. She's young, very, very liberal. They put her into, she worked as a public defender, and she specialized in child abuse cases. And she did it for a few years, and she just quit. She said, I began to mm-hmm. hate my clients. I just wanted them to be guilty, and I'm trying to defend them. And she just emotionally couldn't do it anymore. And I think it is very stressful for child care workers, particularly the really bad cases. And I think that we have to be more aware that we're sending human beings to do something.
Yeah.
And we have to also give them the support that they need, economic and maybe emotional.
Yeah, legal.
Yeah, well, and also just on that same line, I think there's something huge to be said for having qualified workers. So if you hire folks that are trained as professional social workers, either bachelor's or master's level, they're going to be more emotionally prepared for what they're getting into.
Isn't there anything in state law that says we have to do that?
No. And we're seeing a huge
okay,
shift away, a huge deprofessionalization of the folks that work there. And I think part of it is like they're in a crisis and they need to get bodies in there to do the job,
right.
but also not of value coming from either Director McKay or the governor's office on the value that professional, qualified, trained social workers bring.
Excellent point.
They just don't understand.
Listen, I want to get this in Doha way, Katie, but we want to say that Democratic Perspective is supported by the two great Democratic organizations. We have Democrats of the Red Rocks, and we have Democrats of the Verde Valley, such as it is, that contribute to our getting this on the air. We have lots and lots of things we're going to talk about. We have lots of local issues coming up, including the Sedona National Mommy Men issues. We had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, Tom O'Halloran, who talked thoroughly about that from Keep Sedona Beautiful organization. I'm starting to see more and more money going into ads on the Sedona. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that.
And what next week, I think we'll shift a little bit to national issues, to the new Iran deal. Very, very important. Much better than anybody expected. And it's being driven by absolute partisan fury against it, who will not listen to the thing.
Speaking of absolute partisan fury, Katie Hobbs is certainly familiar with that at this Arizona State Legislature.
Thank you for being with us. And keep up the good work, and
yes,
we'll have you on maybe next year. We can get an update on what's happening in the state senate from the Democratic Party.
You have supporters you don't even know about.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
All right. Well, we got you can get this podcast on vvid.org. You can listen to this and all our shows. Go to our website www.vvid.org. And please listen to our podcast and our live shows as they occur. Next Monday, 8:15, we'll be right here on KAZM.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.